Well, then we've got Parshas Amor, and the I decided I'd like to talk about the end of the Parsha, a strange story that shows up there. The story is known either as that of the Mekalel or the Megadef. We'll see the story shortly, but first I wanted to show you a question, which was asked of the Radbaz, and you can see it in source number one on the sheet. The Radbaz was a leading halachic authority, end of the 15th century, as I wrote there, beginning of the 16th century, actually born in Spain, went to Israel, then to Egypt. And Shaal Tamimeni, he says, you, the questioner, asked me the following question. Odia Chadati, you wanted me to give you my opinion. Be'ilu ha-pritzim ha-ovrim averos b'yad rama u'b'shat nefesh. We have people who are not following halacha. They're lawbreakers. They violate b'yad rama with a mighty hand, shat nefesh with a wanton spirit. Uchshaboyim li'yaser osam. Omrim she'amiru. So the community says, we have to bring you in line. We're going to punish you for this. And they say, you do that, we're leaving. We'll go, assimilate, we'll go become Christians, Muslims, whatever, whichever land he's talking about probably determines which religion it is they're going to join. But they say, we can always convert out. So the question is, ha'im ni'asero sam b'lo nachush olo? Should we say, too bad, we have to do our job, we have to, whatever the community punishment is, for whatever the crime is, we have to carry it out? Or do we say, hold back? We don't want to drive anybody away from Torah. So if this question had been put to you, what would you say?
It depends on the circumstance of the individual and, I think the times also have a big determining factor, how to respond to the person, but I think it's based on individuality and personal, experiences and what they're going through.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say individuality, I see Miriam come on with that background. Oh, different background now. Okay. That was an individual background. So, you say it's dependent on their individual circumstances. What sort of a case would lead you to say, yes, let's punish them, and whatever they decide to do is their problem?
Daraisa.
Okay. So if they're doing anything that is a violation of a daraisa, that's biblical violation, then too bad. If we punish them and they leave, it's their problem. Whereas the derabbanan, not. So it's about the seriousness of the crime. Okay.
Maybe it's how it's affecting the community. Like if it's something like they're being mechal Shabbos in their own home, so then obviously it's not permissible, but it's not affecting the community. If it's something like walking around and stealing or something that's affecting other people in the community, then maybe you should come against it, but something that they're doing that is obviously not, it's breaking halacha, but also keep the peace. I think nowadays, we don't walk around punishing people that are doing things that aren't, they kind of want to let them be within who they are, and if it's not affecting the community in a negative way, then maybe we don't punish or persecute or whatever.
Right. I mean, it's interesting to realize the trend in halacha over the last 100 to 200 years has been not to punish people harshly, not because they would threaten, we're going to leave if you do, but because it was understood that it would drive them away, coupled with a sense that the world that we live in, people are not truly considered intentional violators of anything. Either because the education is poor, or because God's hand is so hidden that people can't really appreciate God at all, or because there's so much confusion about what halacha even is at this point in a world of subjective truth and in a world of denominations and so on, that people often think what they're doing is permitted. So all sorts of justifications have been brought, the Binyan Siyam, the Chazon Ish, many others, for saying, let's not punish people, let's not jump to do it. But in the Radbaz's time, it was a very different world, and they would be much quicker to punish in much more severe ways. So let's see. But right now we have a couple of factors. Is it affecting the community or not? Is it a serious crime that they committed or not? Let's go with this, unless anyone had anything to add on that. And before we do, okay, don't.
Sorry, but something's making me think about Chavez. You know, you teach our children that they're in, you know, schools where they are, you know, religious. So you always have to listen to your parents, except if they tell you to be in a fall Chavez.
Right.
Like, always didn't sit like perfectly with me because I mean, Chavez is not able to make sense, but I would think there would also be other things too. Like if you were about to, I don't know, really. Your parent told you it really, really hurts. I don't know. Like, but it's interesting. So maybe some feeling it has to have something to do with Shabbos. I think that I don't know.
I mean, Shabbos certainly has unique status. A person who rejects Shabbos is considered to reject belief in God, belief that God created the world. The thing with the parents, and you know, when the parent says versus when the child says, you know, when the parent says violate Shabbos, is not only about Shabbos. The reason why we mention Shabbos there is because the pasuk says Ishimo ve'aviv tirahu ve'ashav sosai tishmoru. Listen to your parents, but keep my Shabbos, and Shabbos will override it. But the truth is, if your parents said to you to eat treif, the same rule would apply. All right, let's go into the part of the parasha that this all relates to. This is a very brief passage I brought you in source number 2. It's incredibly confusing, though. Vayetze ben Isha Yisraelis. A son of an Israelite woman went out. Vehu ben Ish Mitzri. He was the son of an Egyptian man. Where did he go out? Besoch b'nei Yisrael. Among the Jews. Vayinatsu b'machaneh. They fought in the camp. Ben ha-Yisraelis v'ish ha-Yisraeli, the son of the Jewish woman and the man who was fully Jewish. Okay, so far so good? What's weird about this sentence already? What's strange? Right, they're both Jewish. Why? What is the issue here with his father's identity that we feel a need to emphasize it? What else?
Who is the Israeli they're talking about?
Yeah, and we're never going to know. We literally never find out. The story is told, no one knows. The Medrash discusses the story, does not say. Some guy. You know what else is strange? Where did the fight take place?
Amongst B'nai Yisrael.
Amongst B'nai Yisrael, and it says? B'machaneh. In the camp. Tell me, where else were they going to fight? You're in the Midbar. Like, where were you going to go? Of course the fight was there. Why are you mentioning that? Not to mention the verb that the pasuk starts with, vayetze, and he went out. Went out from where? Doesn't say. He went out. Went out from his house. Why did you tell me that? The whole pasuk is giving me details. There's a lot of information, but assembling that is challenging. Then we get the next pasuk. Vayikov ben ha'isha ha'yisraelit et Hashem. The word vayikov is an odd word. There are different ways to render it. I chose proclaimed. He declared explicitly the name of God. This is the son of the Jewish woman and non-Jewish man. Vayikalel, and he cursed. Vayaviu oso el Moshe. And they brought him to Moshe. And by the way, his mother was Shlomis Bas Divri. Might as well throw that in here. Why not? We're at the end of his story of the tribe of Dan. And that's it. The rest of this passage at the end of the parsha is that they go to God. Moshe goes to God, asks him what to do, and God's answer is a person who blasphemes is put to death, And then we get a whole bunch of other punishments that are mentioned before this the execution is actually carried out. It's a very strange passage. What do you make of this second pasuk?
I thought
yeah.
that here continuing your question about circumstances and what to punish, I thought of age. And now when it says the son, I think of age as well.
Mm-hmm.
Where are they up to in life? What is their chance of coming back or becoming a gadol gador in the end? Or is this a moment of unforgivable no matter what age?
Right. That's an interesting question. From the text itself, I have no way to know, except he's the son of an Egyptian man, but that could be anything. That doesn't really give me any information. We're going to have more information shortly from a midrash, and that's going to put him at somewhere around 80, 81 years old. He's not a young man. Actually, not 81, I'm sorry, 61. Now he's a young man. So, we have to figure this out. I agree with you that age can be a factor if I'm thinking about what he, you know, whether he can do tshuva, what's the likelihood of returning. But I'm confused by this story. Why did fighting with some guy, some anonymous guy, lead him to utter a curse against God? You have to realize, when the text here talks about blasphemy, when it talks about Vayikov and Vayikhalel, it's not like the type of swearing that somebody does in English. That's not what we're talking about. The Gemara walks us through what's actually involved, and it's basically a declaration that God should strike God. It doesn't even make any sense. It's such a strange concept, and I don't understand why fighting with somebody should lead somebody to say something like this. Not to mention why do you mention his mother's name and his tribe at the end of the story? What does that have to do with anything? So all of this is going to help us, I think, answer the question of Radbaz. Take a look at the midrash I brought you in source number 3, which offers an explanation that addresses all of our questions about what in the world is going on here. It's a sifra, halachic midrash. Minayin yatsa, where did he come from? Where did he go out that he did this? Hello. Where did he go out from? Mi beis dino shel Moshe, from Moshe's beit din, from Moshe's court. Shabalita ohalo besoch machane dan. This fellow wanted to set up his tent in the tribe of Dan. Amrulo, and they said to him, Mativach lita besoch machane dan. Who are you? By what right do you claim land in our area? Amar lahen mibnos Dan ani. He said, well, my mother is from Dan. Amrulo, they said to him, Hakasuv omer ish al diglo ve'osos leveis avosam yachanu b'nei Yisrael. The pasuk says that they're going to camp by the flag of Beit Avotam, their father's house. You're out of luck. Your father's not from Dan. Nichnas leveis dino shel Moshe. So he goes to Moshe. He says, I'm going to the highest court. I want answers. V'yatza mechuyav. And he lost the case. V'amad v'gidev. And that was what led him to blaspheme against God. How did you get that story from these psukim? So, vayetze, right? He went out from somewhere. Where did he go out? He went out to try to get living space among his mother's tribe of Dan. He wanted to go to those who are fully Jewish and get land with them. That led to a fight with Ish HaYisraeli. He gets into a fight with somebody who is fully Jewish who says, no, I want that land. You don't have the right to be here. he is Yotzei. He goes out. He goes to the Beis Din when he's been rejected in this way because his father is Egyptian, and he loses the case. And so he went out of Moshe's Beit Din. Really, the Vayetzei is from Moshe's Beit Din. He went out from Moshe's court and he blasphemed against God. I got lost in telling the story versus answering our questions. Where did he go out from? He went out from the Beis Din. His ancestry is relevant. Why? Because that's what drives the entire story. He fights with an Israelite man. The point is not just to say he fought with an Israelite man. There's no one else he's going to fight with. However, the fight was about the fact that this man was Jewish and he was not. They fought in the camp, meaning they fought about the camp, about having the right to pitch your tent somewhere. And he blasphemes against God because he loses the case. And we mention the tribe of the blasphemer's mother because it's relevant to the story. Those were the people who denied him a place to live. Clear?
Okay. Why not open with his ancestry?
Why not open by saying that he was... Well, you do, really. You just don't open with the word done. You open with the fact that his mother's Jewish and his father's Egyptian. Right? That's how we introduced him. But you're right. This midrash, like many midrashim, does an excellent job of analyzing text and picking it apart and answering problems. But when you put it all together, I look at it and say, number one, there are things about this that I would have done differently if that's really the story. And number two, you look at it and say, well, then why didn't you just tell me that? Like, the Torah is fully capable of telling a story straight when it wants to. There are a lot of details they could have put in here instead of playing a hinting game in order to get us to this point. And I don't have an answer for why the Torah would choose to tell it in this strange way. But what Midrash is trying to do is it's paying attention to language, things like the emphasis on the fight being in the camp, and saying, okay, it must have been about the camp, and building a case out of that. There's a technical problem with this Midrash, which is that the Torah only gives us the rule. That pasuk that is quoted here, Isha diglo be'osos levesavosam, that each one will be with his flag according to his father's house, that pasuk actually only shows up in the beginning of the book of Bamidbar. That pasuk hasn't happened yet. So, the Divrei David, Rabbi David Halevi, who's also known as the Taz, which is the name of his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, suggested that even when they set up the system of tribes and flags and all that, they were just extending something that already existed. That's what I brought you in source number 4. They were already living by tribes. So don't get hung up on the question of why you're invoking a system that hasn't happened yet. They were always staying by tribe. This also ties into a completely different question. There's somebody else in the Midbar, in Parshas Shlach, who ends up also being held while they wait for God to say what to do, the Mekoshesh, the person who was gathering wood. So there's some discussion whether those stories happen at the same time or not. I'm not going into that right now. But reading the story in this light, right? Reading the story this way, the way the Midrash paints it, the story of the blasphemer is tragic. I mean, you can't say it's not his fault, because he chose to do what he did. But he's a victim of what his mother did with an Egyptian man. He is forever identified with a sin that he did not commit. He goes to his maternal tribe, his closest Jewish relatives, and says, take me in. And they turn him away. He goes to Moshe, who's supposed to be worried about everybody, right? Moshe goes running after the sheep to make sure that the sheep is going to have something to drink. And Moshe turns him away as well. He finds no recourse with Moshe either. The Shevet is correct. He doesn't have a claim on their land. Moshe, for his part, is only implementing the law. But as I read it, I'm left to wonder if the blasphemer and his mother are the only people at fault in this story. You know what I mean? Hello?
Yeah.
You know, and you gotta wonder, like, it seems like he's getting a raw deal. in what we're doing here. The it's a very difficult story. To me, it's a difficult story. So, incidentally, just as a side note, if you look at source number 5, this is from it's the next to last verse in this story, where the Torah says, "Mishpat echad yiyeh lachem, you shall have one justice for all of you, ka ger ka ezrach yiyeh, for stranger and native alike." Right? Ki ani Hashem Elokeichem. That pasuk doesn't seem to have anything to do with anything. The only way that that pasuk actually makes sense in this story is if I take the version of it in the Sifra, that it was in fact, he went to Beis Din, and there was this fight, and it all played out. That's a side note. But he's been ostracized here. He's been told, you don't have a place in the Sheva. You don't have a place in the tribe. That's a dangerous game, kicking somebody out like this. And it's something which comes back to bite us in Tanakh. The one example of this, I didn't bring it on the sheet, is the story of Yiftach. Yiftach is who? What was Yiftach's role? What do we know about him? Sorry? Yiftach was a shofet. Yiftach is one of the shoftim. But he has a very, very difficult story. First of all, the business with his daughter, in which he makes a vow that if he wins the battle, then whoever comes out of his house first is going to be a gift to God, and that ends up being his daughter. But beyond that, after he wins his war, there's a fight. The tribe of Ephraim complains and says, why didn't you summon us to go to war with you? We would have been part of it. And instead of trying to calm them down and deal with them, he massacres them. Thousands and thousands of people die. And you look at it and you say to yourself, how do you become like that? How do you get there? And the answer, when you look in the beginning of his story, I didn't bring it on here, I really should have, is Shoft in the beginning of Perek Yudal, beginning of chapter 11, you find out that Yiftach was born to an Isha Zona. And his half-brothers say, you don't deserve to be with us. And they kick him out of the house. And he grows up away from everybody else. And you read that and have to ask yourself, you know, how much of that generates the... I'm getting a little jumping on my screen. I don't know if you're getting that also. Can you see? You all right? Okay. So you wonder how much of Yiftach's later behavior is framed by what he went through in his youth, where his siblings kicked him out of the house because of his ancestry. Then you get another story, one which we actually talked about last year when we talked about Amalek. Remember, we traced Amalek to its roots. Amalek's father is Eliphaz, the firstborn of Esav. But Amalek's mother is a woman by the name of Timnah. And if you take a look at the Gemara in source number 6, the Gemara tells us what Timnah's backstory was. Timnah was a daughter of kings. And this is based on, well, all of this that you're going to see in the Gemara is based on the fact that Timnah is described as a concubine of Eliphaz. And she's the one who produces Amalek. However, her name is also associated with the heads of the tribes of Seir, Aluf Timnah. So the Gemara is puzzled. How did she end up as a Pelegish? How did she end up as a concubine if she was actually royalty? And their answer is what you see in the Gemara here in number 6, which is she wanted to join us. She wanted to join Avraham and Sarah's family. She said, I want to be one of you. And they turned her away. And so she went and joined Esav's family instead, saying better to be a concubine with them than to be a princess elsewhere. And the message that the Gemara gives is that's how you get an Amalek. Because you drove her away, she carried hatred, which she communicated to her son. And as the Gemara says, they should not have distanced her. So here the Gemara is saying that there's the greatest hatred against the Jews is a product, at least in part, of us having driven her away because she wasn't worthy. Another example, the Gemara at the end of Sota, in source number 7, gives us a famous phrase. Le'olam tehe smol docha v'min mikarevet. Right, you've heard that phrase? The left hand should push away, the right hand should draw near. Use the left to push away, the right to draw near. What does that mean? What's that message?
Isn't that like with a convert that you, like, you want, right? No? Like with a convert, you're not supposed to, like, welcome them in first. Like, you're supposed to try to, like, keep some distance until you know that they're... you really want to join?
Right. So when somebody says they want to convert to Judaism, it's true that we test their sincerity first by trying to dissuade them from it and pointing out all the problems that are associated with it. We shouldn't be rude, but we do try to make sure that they're actually serious about it, and the momentum has to come from them, and the desire to convert has to come from them. We can't try to convince them to convert. That's true. But this is actually dealing with people who are Jewish. Smol docha v'min mikareves means you push people away with your weaker hand. I don't know if any of you are lefties. Any lefties? Okay? So then this is true for all of you. You push away with the weaker hand and you draw near with the stronger hand. There are times when you need to push somebody away, but don't let that be the dominant move. The dominant move should be trying to draw them near. And the Gemara says that Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, was rejected too strongly. Gehazi has his own story. I didn't want to go into the whole thing. But the Gemara talks about it. It's found in Malachim. That Gehazi had acted inappropriately, and Elisha shoves him away. That's one. And the other is Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya, who is one of the sages of the Mishnah, and they tell a story also about he rejects a student of his very strongly, and depending on which edition of the Gemara you have, his student may have grown up to become none other than Yeshu HaNotzri, in some editions. The chronology doesn't really work historically in terms of when Rabbi Yeshua ben Prachya lived. Nonetheless, the message is, you don't chase people away. So based on that, based on the Gemara, and based on what we're saying here, could we draw the conclusion that the story of the Mekalel, the story of the Magadev, as it's being told in this Medrash, is a polemic for inclusion? We should embrace people, don't push people away. Is that the message so far? What would you say? Why not?
I feel like it's saying push them away. Like, I'm not sure why. It wouldn't have been what I thought. I'm still just, we didn't get to the end yet. But
right. What makes you say from here that the message is to push away?
Based on how, that was the essence of the story before, like even Moshe wouldn't take him in to stand the bottom, if I can't remember.
Well, is Moshe right in the end? In other words, sorry?
I think not, but I'm waiting for you to get there, right? I'm saying there's going to be a chain, right?
Right.
It can't be right. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't seem right.
Right.
Maybe I heard the whole, it seems terrible.
I mean, if you had asked me at this stage, I would have said, this story is trying to tell me what the Gemara in Sota says, which is that they were wrong. That they should not have pushed him away like this, that they should have embraced him. The problem is, what do you do? The law is, he has no right to that land. I'm not clear on what you're supposed to do, but it sounds like, to me, right now, this story is a message of inclusion, like the story of Yiftach, like the story in Sanhedrin with Timnah and Amalek, and like the stories in Sota. That's what I would have assumed. This is about inclusion, and it's pro-inclusion. That's the way I would have read it. But there's a problem. And the problem is everything in Sefer Vayikra until this point. If you flip the page and look at source number 8, I gave you a quick outline of what Sefer Vayikra looks like until here. Chapters 8 and 9 in Parshas Tzav have the dedication of the Kohanim to work in the Mishkan, setting them apart from all the Jews. You're a Kohen or you are a Zar, a non-Kohen. Then, in chapter 11, in Parshas Shmini, we learn all about how some of the animals, some of the birds, some of the fish, some of the creepy crawly creatures are going to be kosher, and the others are not kosher. And some of them are pure, some of them are tahor, and some of them are tamei. So again, distinctions being made. These are the ones who are in, and these are the ones who are out. And then you go from there into Tazria Mitzora, and we're taught all about who is tamei and who is tahor, who gets to stay in the camp and who has to be kicked out of the camp. And then, in the end of Achrimos, and further in Kedoshim, we're told about the behavior of the Egyptians and the Canaanim, and don't be like them, you have to be like this, and you should never emulate them. Before in Parshas Emor, you get to Emor, and you're back to the theme again of Kohanim versus non-Kohanim, and Kohanim who are eligible to work versus Kohanim who are not eligible to work. We keep on building walls throughout Sefer Vayikra, and the message is exclude, exclude, exclude. I think it's a very hard thing to say that a few sentences in chapter 24, as explained by the Medrash, are a denial of the legitimacy of the many chapters that preceded them. I think that that's difficult. It's a little bit of wishful thinking. I don't like to exclude, so I'm going to take this story and say, see that? We're not meant to be exclusive. Even as it comes after 16 chapters that were all about being exclusive. You see the problem? Right? I view this story as trying to tell me something which is inconsistent with everything that came before it. And I'll make the case worse. Halacha seems to say, to go back to the Radbaz now, halacha seems to say to exclude, even if it's going to lead a person away. This is actually a great debate. Take a look at source number 9. It's a Gemara at the end of Kiddushin. Ki havanecha nafshei de Rebbe. Rebbe, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, was dying. When he was dying, he said certain things. One of the things that he said was to describe communities in Bavel, which were problematic. Jewish communities in Bavel, which were problematic. He's living in Israel, but he's talking about what's going on in Babylon. And one of the things he said was, there is a town called Birka, in which Shnei Achim Yesha Machlifim Nashoseim Zela Zeh. There are two brothers who trade wives with each other. There's another town called Birta Desatya, which may not be the name of it. It may just be Birasa Desatya. It's the town that strays. But what goes on there? They have abandoned God. Their pond flooded with fish on Shabbos, and they went and trapped the fish on Shabbos. So Rabbi Achi, son of Rabbi Oshia, goes out and excommunicates these people, and they assimilate out. The Trumas Hadeshen, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlein, a leading authority in early Ashkenaz, looked at that Gemara and he says, he excommunicated them, even though it was going to drive them away. That teaches us that you don't worry about the consequences. They're doing something wrong, kick them out. That's the position that the Trumas Hadeshen takes, and the Rama ruled that way. In source number 10, Rabbi Moshe Isser lists the Rama, says, Menadin lemishu chayev nidui. If somebody deserves excommunication, we do it. Vafilu yeshlachu shayudei kein yetze the tarbus ra. Even if we are concerned that that could lead him away, ein lachush bekach. Doesn't make a difference. We remove him. We excommunicate him, and if he goes, he goes. Very strong position. This was actually a great debate among halachic authorities for centuries as to whether we go that far. There's an article, a good article on this, in the 19th volume of the journal Truman, by Rabbi Yonah Fodor. I don't know who he is, but he wrote an article called Smol Dochavi Min Mikarevet, this theme of pushing away with the left, drawing near with the right, in which he tracks this debate among major authorities. The Rama said, push him away. That's the way it goes. If he leaves, he leaves. The Taz, who we quoted before, in his commentary to the Shulchan Aruch in Yaredeya, says, no, not true. We do not push him away. And he says, I'll prove it to you. Take a look at source number 11. I'm going to read 11 outside of the text. The Gemara looks at a sequence of events described at the end of Sefer Vayikra, in which we talk about people who violate the laws of Shemitah, and then we talk about people falling into increasingly greater levels of need, economic, financial need. And the Gemara sees it as cause and effect. If a person trades illegally in Shemitah produce, he is going to find that he's not doing well financially, and he's going to have to sell off his property. And that's not going to work. He's going to need not only to sell off his movable stuff, he's going to have to sell off his fields, he's going to have to sell off his home, he's going to sell his daughter, he's going to have to borrow money and pay interest, he's going to have to sell himself, and he's going to sell himself not to you, but to a stranger, he's going to sell himself ultimately to work for Avodah Zarah. All because he tried to make money off of Shemitah produce. That's what the Gemara says. And then along comes Abaye and says, yeah, but you know what? There's still an obligation to redeem him. If he goes off and sells himself for Avodah Zarah, we're still supposed to redeem him, to buy him back. So that tells you that within the context of the Gemara, we don't give up on anyone. Even though he was the one who brought himself to this position, nonetheless, we're going to try to bring him back. So along comes the Taz, commenting on the Shulchan Aruch, and he says, aha! See that? We do redeem. We do bring people back. And the Radbaz, now we come back to source number one, says, well, I have the Rama on one side saying, excommunicate them, it's their problem. And I have the Taz on the other side saying no. The Radbaz says, follow the Rama. The Radbaz says, follow the Rama. He says, excommunicate them. The Radbaz also throws in a line from his own experience, one thinks, in which he says, you should know, if people say to you, if you punish me, I'm going to leave, odds are they're leaving anyway. That's a little bit of personal experience, it sounds like, weighing in on that. But this was a classic debate for a very long time. Rav Moshe Sofer, the Chasam Sofer, dealt with this issue, and he gave an interesting answer in source number 12. He distinguishes between, he's talking about the issue of the effects on one's children, meaning if you're going to kick somebody out, what about their kids? And he says it depends. If you're talking about somebody who is anti-everything, hostile to everything, is going to raise his kids to hate Judaism, then you haven't changed anything by kicking him out. They were not going to come around anyway. However, he says, if it's just that they do some things that are wrong, then there's still a chance to save their kids. That's the Chasam Sofer's position. If you take a look at source number 12, I'll read out my translation. He says, it's not remote to say that one who catches fish on Shabbos did not perform a biblical prohibition, only rabbinic with a root in the Torah. And yet, he excommunicated them because they challenged, right? In that story with the people who caught the fish, number 9, he excommunicated them because they challenged the Torah. And so he was not concerned for their children after them. But one who is stubborn and a routine sinner, who could say we should not be concerned for his children who may be righteous? How could we chase them away from sheltering in the portion of God? He says, you have to know who you're dealing with. The fishermen on Shabbos, maybe there's something bigger that's wrong there. But otherwise, we don't want to send their kids away. The Chasam Sofer's point is, it's not the fault of the children, and you could make things worse for them. I would also add a pragmatic point, which I brought you in source number 13 and in source number 14. which is the Gemara says you should be very careful in how you deal with the children of the needy in source number 13 and the children of the uneducated in source number 14, because Torah will ultimately be able to emerge from them. In other words, they could end up becoming great. So what emerges from this, to me, is the following. Number one, that this issue of do you push away or not push away is complicated within halacha. But the message we're getting here in this story of the Mekalel, of the Megadef, both are used for it. But the message here to me is not a message of never push people away. It's not a message that all exclusion is bad. You have to acknowledge the rest of the book of Vayikra. And the rest of the book of Vayikra is a book of Havdalah. It's a book of distinctions. However, Havdalah is not the same as ostracism. It's adding a new lesson to what came before. There are times when you need to draw a line. There are times when you need to say, I'm sorry, you don't have a claim on the land. But you don't stop there. You look for a way to bring them back. You look for a way to even as you mark the difference, to yet include them. And I think it's adding to what was said before. You exclude, but be careful how you do it. And in that light, I view this story not so much as a conclusion of what came before in Vayikra, but as an introduction to what comes next. Take a look at source number 15, please. Our passage from the end of Amor leads to the beginning of Behar. And there you see a whole bunch of rules that convey inclusion and looking after the vulnerable. The laws of Shemitah and Yovel, right? Where you open up your fields for people to be able to take those who don't have are able to come in and collect so that they'll be able to eat. In Yovel, every 50th year, you return land to its ancestral holders who sold it due to poverty. We get the rule of Ona'ah. You're not allowed to use your strength, your dominant position in commerce to take advantage of those who are desperate to sell or to buy. You get the laws about redeeming fields on behalf of the needy who are forced to sell them, so you try to buy the field back for them. We get the rule of walled cities, that walled cities don't return in Yovel. And this goes back to a shiur we had last year about whether God likes walls or doesn't like walls. I'm not going to revisit that right now. But we talked about the difference in walls that include and walls that exclude. Then we're taught all about making sure that money is available for the needy, free of charge. You're not allowed to charge interest when you lend to them. Followed by a whole bunch of laws of taking care of people who are sold as slaves. Whether they're sold to Jews, whether they're sold to non-Jews. So the entire next chapter follows from this story. It's all about taking care of those who have ended up on the outside. So what we're saying is this, whether it's due to logic and reason, or whether it's just the Torah said so, there are certain people, there are certain creatures, there are certain situations in which there are those who are in, and there are those who are out. And you have to recognize and respect that. However, we moderate the message. It's not about leaving the excluded to their own devices. And that message begins with the son of an Egyptian man. He's a product of a prohibited relationship. He has no claim on the territory of Shevet Dan. But the reaction has to be to embrace him and find ways to help. Like the person who sold his land, like the person who's desperate for a sale, like the person who sells himself, they have a claim on our support. And I think this is important, not only in terms of the obvious case of the needy, but I think it's important in a much bigger way. There are always people who lose. Right? In every debate, in every situation, there are always people who win and there are people who lose. There are people who lose elections. There are people whose ideas are defeated in the public arena. Being disenfranchised is painful and dangerous. And if we are going to survive, we have to look for those who have been excluded, even if the exclusion was necessary. Even if they ended up on the outs because their idea was wrong. Nonetheless, you can't drive them away, I think. And I'll close with a pasuk that I really like in source number 16. Pasuk in Yeshaya, from the beginning of the prakim of the chapters of Nichum, of consolation. He says, He says, raise your eyes up to the heavens and see who created these. What is it? What are the these? Look up to the heavens and see who created these. These are the stars. Right? And who is compared to the stars? We are. Right? That's us. So look up to the stars and see who created these. Hamotzi v'mispar tzivaam. The one who brings them out in all their multitudes by number. He has a number for each. L'chulam b'shem yikra. He calls each one by name. Merov onim v'amitz kawach. Ish lo ne'edar. Because of Hashem's great strength and power, not a single one will be lost. You can't drive anybody away. Ish lo ne'edar. No one is supposed to be lost. And that, to me, is the big message that we're supposed to take away from this story. As the Midrash explains the story of the Mekalel, he was given the wrong answer. It was the right answer. It was true. But it wasn't the whole answer. There should have been that embrace, and because there wasn't, you saw where he ended up. Clear? Yeah, thank you. So, you've got the review questions on here. I think this one is fairly straightforward. I don't know if review questions were really needed, but hopefully they will help. Should I go through them? I mean, I don't want to hold people late. I think we're good. All right. But thank you very much. And God willing, we'll be back again next week for Bahar B'chu Kosai. Okay?
Thank you.